Chapter 25. The Visit to Lord Pococurante, a Noble Venetian. Candide and Martin went in a gondola on the Brenta and arrived at the palace of the noble Signor Pococurante. The gardens, laid out with taste, were adorned with fine marble statues. The palace was beautifully built. The master of the house was a man of 60 and very rich. He received the two travellers with polite indifference, which put Candide a little out of countenance, but was not at all disagreeable to Martin. First, two pretty girls, very neatly dressed, served them with chocolate, which was frothed exceedingly well. Candide could not refrain from commending their beauty, grace, and address.
"They are good enough creatures," said the senator. "I make them lie with me sometimes, for I'm very tired of the ladies of the town, of their coquetries, of their jealousies, of their quarrels, of their humours, of their pettinesses, of their prides, of their follies, and of the sonnets which one must make, or have made, for them. But after all, these two girls begin to weary me."
After breakfast, Candide, walking into a long gallery, was surprised by the beautiful pictures. He asked by what master were the two first.
"They are by, Raphael," said the senator. "I bought them at a great price, out of vanity, some years ago. They are said to be the finest things in Italy, but they do not please me at all. The colours are too dark. The figures are not sufficiently rounded, nor in good relief. The draperies in no way resemble stuffs. In a word, whatever may be said, I do not find there a true imitation of nature. I only care for a picture when I think I see nature itself, and there are none of this sort. I have a great many pictures, but I prize them very little."
While they were waiting for dinner, Pococurante ordered a concert. Candide found the music delicious.
"This noise," said the senator, "may amuse one for half an hour, but if it were to last longer it would grow tiresome to everybody, though they durst not own it. Music today is only the art of executing difficult things, and that which is only difficult cannot please long. Perhaps I should be fonder of the opera if they had not found the secret of making it a monster which shocks me. Let who will go to see bad tragedies set to music, where the scenes are contrived for no other end than to introduce two or three songs ridiculously out of place, to show off an actress's voice. Let who will, or who can, die away with pleasure at the sight of an eunuch quavering the role of Caesar or of Cato, and strutting awkwardly upon the stage. For my part, I have long since renounced those paltry entertainments which constitute the glory of modern Italy, and are purchased so dearly by sovereigns."
Candide disputed the point a little, but with discretion. Martin was entirely of the senator's opinion. They sat down to table, and after an excellent dinner they went into the library. Candide, seeing a Homer magnificently bound, commended the virtuoso on his good taste. "There," said he, "is a book that was once the delight of the great Pangloss, the best philosopher in Germany."
"It is not mine," answered Pococurante coolly. "They used at one time to make me believe that I took a pleasure in reading him, but that continual repetition of battles, so extremely like one another, those gods that are always active without doing anything decisive, that Helen, who is the cause of the war, and yet who scarcely appears in the piece, that Troy, so long besieged without being taken, all these together caused me great weariness. I have sometimes asked learned men whether they were not as weary as I of that work. Those who were sincere have owned to me that the poem made them fall asleep. Yet it was necessary to have it in a library as a monument of antiquity, or like those rusty medals which are no longer of use in commerce."
"But Your Excellency does not think thus of Virgil," said Candide.
"I grant," said the senator, "that the second, fourth, and sixth books of his Aeneid are excellent, but as for his pious Aeneas, his strong Cloanthus, his friend Achates, his little Ascanius, his silly King Latinus, his bourgeois Amata, his insipid Lavinia, I think there can be nothing more flat and disagreeable. I prefer Tasso a good deal, or even the soporific tales of Ariosto.
May I presume to ask you, sir, said Candide, whether you do not receive a great deal of pleasure from reading Horace?
There are maxims in this writer, answered Pococurante, from which a man of the world may reap great benefit, and being written in energetic verse, they are more easily impressed upon the memory. But I care little for his journey to Brundusium, and his account of a bad dinner, or of his low quarrel between one Rupilius, whose words, he says, were full of poisonous filth, and another whose language was imbued with vinegar. I've read with much distaste his indelicate verses against old women and witches, nor do I see any merit in telling his friend Maecenas that if he will but rank him in the choir of lyric poets, his lofty head shall touch the stars. Fools admire everything in an author of reputation. For my part, I read only to please myself. I like only that which serves my purpose.
Candide, having been educated never to judge for himself, was much surprised at what he heard. Martin found there was a good deal of reason in Pococurante's remarks.
"Oh, here is Cicero," said Candide. "Here is the great man whom I fancy you are never tired of reading."
"I never read him," replied the Venetian.
"What is it to me whether he pleads for Abirius or Cluentius? I try causes enough myself. His philosophical works seemed to me better, but when I found that he doubted of everything, I concluded that I knew as much as he, and that I had no need of a guide to learn ignorance.
Ah, here are 40 volumes of the Academy of Sciences," cried Martin. "Perhaps there's something valuable in this collection."
"There might be," said Pococurante, "if only one of those rakers of rubbish had shown how to make pins. But in all these volumes there is nothing but chimerical systems, and not a single useful thing."
"And what dramatic works I see here," said Candide, "in Italian, Spanish, and French."
"Yes," replied the senator, "there are 3,000, and not 36 of them good for anything. As to those collections of sermons, which altogether are not worth a single page of Seneca, and those huge volumes of theology, you may well imagine that neither I nor anyone else ever opens them."
Martin saw some shelves filled with English books.
"I have a notion," said he, "that a republican must be greatly pleased with most of these books, which are written with a spirit of freedom."
"Yes," answered Pococurante, "it is noble to write as one thinks. This is the privilege of humanity. In all our Italy, we write only what we do not think. Those who inhabit the country of the Caesars and the Antoninuses dare not acquire a single idea without the permission of a Dominican friar. I should be pleased with the liberty which inspires the English genius, if passion and party spirit did not corrupt all that is estimable in this precious liberty."
Candide, observing a Milton, asked whether he did not look upon this author as a great man.
"Who?" said Pococurante. "That barbarian who writes a long commentary in 10 books of harsh verse on the first chapter of Genesis? That coarse imitator of the Greeks who disfigures the creation, and who, while Moses represents the Eternal producing the world by a word, makes the Messiah take a great pair of compasses from the armory of heaven to circumscribe his work? How can I have any esteem for a writer who has spoiled Tasso's hell, and the devil who transforms Lucifer sometimes into a toad and other times into a pygmy, who makes him repeat the same things 100 times, who makes him dispute on theology, who, by a serious imitation of Ariosto's comic invention of firearms, represents the devil's cannonading in heaven? Neither I nor any man in Italy could take pleasure in those melancholy extravagances. And the marriage of sin and death, and the snakes brought forth by sin, are enough to turn the stomach of anyone with the least taste. And his long description of a pest-house is good only for a grave-digger. This obscure, whimsical, and disagreeable poem was despised upon its first publication, and I only treat it now as it was treated in its own country by contemporaries. For the matter of that, I say what I think, and I care very little whether others think as I do."
Candide was grieved at this speech, for he had a respect for Homer, and was fond of Milton.
"Alas," said he softly to Martin, "I am afraid that this man holds our German poets in very great contempt.
There would not be much harm in that, said Martin.
Oh, what a superior man, said Candide below his breath. What a great genius is this Pococurante. Nothing can please him.
After their survey of the library, they went down into the garden, where Candide praised its several beauties.
I know nothing in so bad a taste, said the master. All you see here is merely trifling. After tomorrow I will have it planted with a nobler design.
Well, said Candide to Martin when they had taken their leave, you will agree that this is the happiest of mortals, for he is above everything he possesses.
But do you not see, answered Martin, that he is disgusted with all he possesses?
Plato observed a long while ago that those stomachs are not the best that reject all sorts of food.
But is there not a pleasure, said Candide, in criticizing everything, in pointing out faults where others see nothing but beauties?
That is to say, replied Martin, that there is some pleasure in having no pleasure.
Well, well, said Candide, I find that I shall be the only happy man when I am blessed with the sight of my dear Cunegonde.
It is always well to hope, said Martin. However, the days and the weeks passed. Cacambo did not come, and Candide was so overwhelmed with grief that he did not even reflect that Paquette and Friar Giroflée did not return to thank him. Chapter 26. Of a supper which Candide and Martin took with six strangers, and who they were. One evening that Candide and Martin were going to sit down to supper with some foreigners who lodged in the same inn, a man whose complexion was as black as soot came behind Candide and, taking him by the arm, said,
"Get yourself ready to go along with us. Do not fail."
Upon this he turned round and saw Cacambo. Nothing but the sight of Cunegonde could have astonished and delighted him more. He was on the point of going mad with joy. He embraced his dear friend.
"Cunegonde is here, without doubt. Where is she? Oh, take me to her that I may die of joy in her company."
"Cunegonde is not here," said Cacambo. "She is at Constantinople."
"Oh, heavens, at Constantinople! But were she in China, I would fly thither. Let us be off."
"We shall set out after supper," replied Cacambo. "I can tell you nothing more. I am a slave. My master awaits me. I must serve him at table. Speak not a word. Eat, and then get ready."
Candide, distracted between joy and grief, delighted at seeing his faithful agent again, astonished at finding him a slave, filled with a fresh hope of recovering his mistress, his heart palpitating, his understanding confused, sat down to table with Martin, who saw all these scenes quite unconcerned, and with six strangers who had come to spend the carnival at Venice. Cacambo waited at table upon one of the strangers. Towards the end of the entertainment he drew near his master and said in his ear,
"Sire, your majesty may start when you please. The vessel is ready."
On saying these words he went out. The company, in great surprise, looked at one another without speaking a word, when another domestic approached his master and said to him,
"Sire, your majesty's chaise is at Padua, and the boat is ready."
The master gave a nod, and the servant went away. The company all stared at one another again, and their surprise redoubled. A third valet came up to a third stranger, saying,
"Sire, believe me, your majesty ought not to stay here any longer. I'm going to get everything ready."
And immediately he disappeared. Candide and Martin did not doubt that this was a masquerade of the carnival. Then a fourth domestic said to a fourth master,
"Your majesty may depart when you please."
Saying this, he went away like the rest. The fifth valet said the same thing to the fifth master. But the sixth valet spoke differently to the sixth stranger, who sat near Candide. He said to him,
"Faith, sire, they will no longer give credit to your majesty nor to me, and we may perhaps both of us be put in jail this very night. Therefore I will take care of myself. Adieu."
The servants being all gone, the six strangers, with Candide and Martin, remained in a profound silence. At length Candide broke it. "Gentlemen," said he, "this is a very good joke indeed, but why should you all be kings? For me, I own that neither Martin nor I is a king." Cacambo's master then gravely answered in Italian,
"I am not at all joking. My name is Ahmed III,
I was Grand Sultan many years. I dethroned my brother. My nephew dethroned me. My viziers were beheaded, and I am condemned to end my days in the old Seraglio. My nephew, the great Sultan Mahmud, permits me to travel sometimes for my health, and I am come to spend the carnival at Venice.
A young man who sat next to Ahmed spoke then as follows.
My name is Ivan. I was once emperor of all the Russias, but was dethroned in my cradle. My parents were confined in prison, and I was educated there. Yet I am sometimes allowed to travel in company with persons who act as guards, and I am come to spend the carnival at Venice.
The third said, I am Charles Edward, King of England. My father has resigned all his legal rights to me. I have fought in defence of them, and above 800 of my adherents have been hanged, drawn, and quartered. I have been confined in prison. I am going to Rome to pay a visit to the king, my father, who was dethroned, as well as myself and my grandfather, and I am come to spend the carnival at Venice.
The fourth spoke thus in his turn.
I am a king of Poland. The fortune of war has stripped me of my hereditary dominions. My father underwent the same vicissitudes. I resigned myself to Providence in the same manner as Sultan Ahmed, the Emperor Ivan, and King Charles Edward, whom God long preserve. And I am come to the carnival at Venice.
The fifth said,
I am king of Poland also. I have been twice dethroned, but Providence has given me another country where I have done more good than all the Sarmatian kings were ever capable of doing on the banks of the Vistula. I resign myself likewise to Providence, and am come to pass the carnival at Venice.
It was now the sixth monarch's turn to speak.
Gentlemen, said he, I am not so great a prince as any of you. However, I am a king. I am Theodore, elected king of Corsica. I had the title of Majesty, and now I am scarcely treated as a gentleman. I have coined money, and now am not worth a farthing. I have had two secretaries of state, and now I have scarce a valet. I have seen myself on a throne, and I have seen myself upon straw in a common jail in London. I am afraid that I shall meet with the same treatment here, though, like your Majesties, I am come to see the carnival at Venice.
The other five kings listened to this speech with generous compassion. Each of them gave 20 sequins to King Theodore to buy him clothes and linen, and Candide made him a present of a diamond worth 2,000 sequins.
"Who can this private person be?" said the five kings to one another, "who is able to give, and really has given, 100 times as much as any of us."
Just as they rose from table, in came 4 Serene Highnesses, who had also been stripped of their territories by the fortune of war, and were come to spend the carnival at Venice. But Candide paid no regard to these newcomers. His thoughts were entirely employed on his voyage to Constantinople in search of his beloved Cunegonde. Chapter 27. Candide's Voyage to Constantinople. The faithful Cacambo had already prevailed upon the Turkish skipper, who was to conduct the Sultan Ahmed to Constantinople, to receive Candide and Martin on his ship. They both embarked after having paid their respects to his miserable highness. "You see," said Candide to Martin on the way, "we supped with 6 dethroned kings, and of those 6 there was one to whom I gave charity. Perhaps there are many other princes yet more unfortunate. For my part, I have only lost 100 sheep, and now I am flying into Cunegonde's arms. My dear Martin, yet once more Pangloss was right. All is for the best."
"I wish it," answered Martin.
"But," said Candide, "it was a very strange adventure we met with at Venice. It has never before been seen or heard that 6 dethroned kings have supped together at a public inn."
"It is not more extraordinary," said Martin, "than most of the things that have happened to us. It is a very common thing for kings to be dethroned, and as for the honour we have had of supping in their company, it is a trifle not worth our attention."
No sooner had Candide got on board the vessel than he flew to his old valet and friend Cacambo and tenderly embraced him. "Well," said he, "what news of Cunegonde? Is she still a prodigy of beauty? Does she love me still? How is she? Thou hast doubtless bought her a palace at Constantinople."
"My dear master," answered Cacambo, "Cunegonde washes dishes on the banks of the Propontis, in the service of a prince who has very few dishes to wash.
She is a slave in the family of an ancient sovereign named Dragotsky, to whom the Grand Turk allows 3 crowns a day in his exile. But what is worse still is that she has lost her beauty, and has become horribly ugly.
Well, handsome or ugly, replied Candide, I am a man of honour, and it is my duty to love her still. But how came she to be reduced to so abject a state with the 5 or 6 millions that you took to her?
No, said Cacambo, was I not to give 2 millions to Señor Don Fernando de Ibarra y Figuera y Mascarenhas y Lampourlos y Souza, governor of Buenos Aires, for permitting Miss Cunegonde to come away? And did not a corsair bravely rob us of all the rest? Did not this corsair carry us to Cape Matapan, to Milo, to Nicaria, to Samos, to Petra, to the Dardanelles, to Marmora, and Scutari? Cunegonde and the old woman serve the prince I now mention to you, and I am slave to the dethroned sultan.
Oh, what a series of shocking calamities, cried Candide. But, after all, I have some diamonds left, and I may easily pay Cunegonde's ransom. Yet it is a pity that she has grown so ugly. Then, turning towards Martin, "'Who do you think,' said he, "'is most to be pitied? "'The Sultan Ahmed? "'The Emperor Ivan? "'King Charles Edward? "'Or I?'
"'How should I know?' answered Martin. "'I must see into your hearts to be able to tell.'
"'Ah,' said Candide, "'if Pangloss were here, he could tell.'
"'I know not,' said Martin, "'in what sort of scales your Pangloss would weigh the misfortunes of mankind.' And set a just estimate on their sorrows. All that I can presume to say is that there are millions of people upon earth who have 100 times more to complain of than King Charles Edward, the Emperor Ivan, or the Sultan Ahmed.
That may well be, said Candide. In a few days they reached the Bosphorus, and Candide began by paying a very high ransom for Cacambo. Then, without losing time, he and his companions went on board a galley in order to search on the banks of the Propontis for his Cunegonde, however ugly she might have become. Among the crew there were 2 slaves who rowed very badly, and to whose bare shoulders the Levantine captain would now and then apply blows from a bull's pizzle. Candide, from a natural impulse, looked at these 2 slaves more attentively than at the other oarsmen, and approached them with pity. Their features, though greatly disfigured, had a slight resemblance to those of Pangloss and the unhappy Jesuit and Westphalian baron, brother to Miss Cunegonde. This moved and saddened him. He looked at them still more attentively. "Indeed," said he to Cacambo, "if I had not seen Master Pangloss hanged, and if I had not had the misfortune to kill the baron, I should think it was they that were rowing." At the names of the baron and of Pangloss, the 2 galley-slaves uttered a loud cry and let drop their oars. The captain ran up to them and redoubled his blows with the bull's pizzle.
"'Stop! Stop, sir!' cried Candide. "'I will give you what money you please!'
"'What? It is Candide!' said one of the slaves.
"'What? It is Candide!' said the other.
"'Do I dream?' cried Candide. "'Am I awake, or am I on board a galley?' Is this the baron whom I killed? Is this Master Pangloss whom I saw hanged?
It is we.
It is we, answered they. Well, is this the great philosopher? Said Martin.
Ah, captain, said Candide, what ransom will you take for Monsieur de Thunder-ten-Tronck, one of the 1st barons of the empire, and for Monsieur Pangloss, the profoundest metaphysician in Germany?
Dog of a Christian! "'Answered the Levantine captain. "'Since these 2 dogs of Christian slaves are barons and metaphysicians, "'which I doubt not are high dignities in their country, oh, "'you shall give me 50,000 sequins.
"'You shall have them, sir. "'Carry me back at once to Constantinople, "'and you shall receive the money directly. But no, carry me first to Miss Cunegonde.'
"'Upon the 1st proposal made by Candide, however, "'the Levantine captain had already tacked about "'and made the crew ply their oars quicker than a bird cleaves the air. "'Candide embraced the baron and Pangloss 100 times. "'And how happened it, my dear baron, that I did not kill you? "'And, my dear Pangloss, how came you to life again after being hanged? "'And why are you both in a Turkish galley? "'It is true that my dear sister is in this country?' said the baron.
"'Yes!' answered Cacambo.
Then I behold once more my dear Candide, cried Pangloss.
Candide presented Martin and Cacambo to them. They embraced each other, and all spoke at once. The galley flew. They were already in the port. Instantly Candide sent for a Jew, to whom he sold for 50,000 sequins a diamond worth 100,000, though the fellow swore to him by Abraham that he could give him no more. He immediately paid the ransom for the Baron and Pangloss. The latter threw himself at the feet of his deliverer and bathed them with his tears. The former thanked him with a nod and promised to return him the money on the first opportunity.
"But is it indeed possible that my sister can be in Turkey?" said he.
"Nothing is more possible," said Cacambo, "since she scours the dishes in the service of a Transylvanian prince."
Candide sent directly for 2 Jews and sold them some more diamonds, and then they all set out together in another galley to deliver Cunegonde from slavery. Chapter 28. What happened to Candide, Cunegonde, Pangloss, Martin, etc.?
I ask your pardon once more, said Candide to the Baron, your pardon, reverend father, for having run you through the body.
Say no more about it, answered the Baron. I was a little too hasty, I own, but since you wish to know by what fatality I came to be a galley slave, I will inform you. After I had been cured by the surgeon of the college of the wound you gave me, I was attacked and carried off by a party of Spanish troops, who confined me in prison at Buenos Aires, at the very time my sister was setting out thence. I asked leave to return to Rome to the general of my order. I was appointed chaplain to the French ambassador at Constantinople. I had not been 8 days in this employment, when one evening I met with young Ichoglan, who was a very handsome fellow. The weather was warm, the young man wanted to bathe, and I took this opportunity of bathing also. I did not know that it was a capital crime for a Christian to be found naked with a young Mussulman. A cadi ordered me 100 blows on the soles of the feet, and condemned me to the galleys. I do not think there ever was a greater act of injustice. But I should be glad to know how my sister came to be scullion to a Transylvanian prince who has taken shelter among the Turks.
You, my dear Pangloss, said Candide, how can it be that I behold you again?
It is true, said Pangloss, that you saw me hanged. I should have been burnt, but you may remember it rained exceedingly hard when they were going to roast me. The storm was so violent that they despaired of lighting the fire, so I was hanged because they could do no better. A surgeon purchased my body, carried me home, and dissected me. He began with making a crucial incision on me from the navel to the clavicula. One could not have been worse hanged than I was. The executioner of the Holy Inquisition was a sub-deacon, and knew how to burn people marvellously well, but he was not accustomed to hanging. The cord was wet, and did not slip properly. And besides, it was badly tied. In short, I still drew my breath when the crucial incision made me give such a frightful scream that my surgeon fell flat upon his back, and, imagining that he had been dissecting the devil, he ran away, dying with fear, and fell down the staircase in his flight. His wife, hearing the noise, flew from the next room. She saw me stretched out upon the table with my crucial incision. She was seized with yet greater fear than her husband, fled, and tumbled over him. When they came to themselves a little, I heard the wife say to her husband, "My dear, how could you take it into your head to dissect a heretic? Do you not know that these people always have the devil in their bodies? I will go and fetch a priest this minute to exorcise him." At this proposal I shuddered, and with what little courage I had still remaining, I cried out aloud, "Have mercy on me!" At length the Portuguese surgeon plucked up his spirits. He sewed up my wounds. His wife even nursed me. I was upon my legs at the end of 15 days. The surgeon found me a place as lackey to a knight of Malta who was going to Venice. But finding that my master had no money to pay me wages, I entered the service of a Venetian merchant and went with him to Constantinople.
One day I took it into my head to step into a mosque, where I saw an old imam and a very pretty young devotee who was saying her paternosters. Her bosom was uncovered, and between her breasts she had a beautiful bouquet of tulips, roses, anemones, ranunculus, hyacinths, and auriculas. She dropped her bouquet. I picked it up and presented to her with a profound reverence. I was so long in delivering it that the imam began to get angry, and seeing that I was a Christian, he called out for help. They carried me before the Cadi, who ordered me 100 lashes on the soles of the feet and sent me to the galleys. I was chained to the very same galley and the same bench as the young baron. On board this galley there were 4 young men from Marseille, 5 Neapolitan priests, and 2 monks from Corfu, who told us similar adventures happened daily.
The baron maintained that he had suffered greater injustice than I, and I insisted that it was far more innocent to take up a bouquet and place it again on a woman's bosom than to be found stark naked with an itcho gland. We were constantly disputing, and received 20 lashes with a bull's pizzle when the concatenation of universal events brought you to our galley, and you were good enough to ransom us.
"Well, my dear Pangloss," said Candide to him, "when you had been hanged, dissected, whipped, and were tugging at the oar, did you always think that everything happens for the best?"
"I am still of my first opinion," answered Pangloss, "for I am a philosopher, and I cannot retract, especially as Leibniz could never be wrong. And besides, the pre-established harmony is the finest thing in the world, and so is his plenum and materia subtilis."
Chapter 29. How Candide Found Cunegonde and the Old Woman Again. While Candide, the Baron, Pangloss, Martin, and Cacambo were relating their several adventures, were reasoning on the contingent or non-contingent events of the universe, disputing on effects and causes, on moral and physical evil, on liberty and necessity, and on the consolations a slave may feel even on a Turkish galley, they arrived at the house of the Transylvanian prince on the banks of the Propontis. The first objects which met their sight were Cunegonde and the old woman hanging towels out to dry. The baron paled at this sight. The tender, loving Candide, seeing his beautiful Cunegonde, weather-beaten, with bloodshot eyes, withered neck, wrinkled cheeks, and rough red arms, recoiled 3 paces, seized with horror, and then advanced out of good manners. She embraced Candide and her brother, they embraced the old woman, and Candide ransomed them both. There was a small farm in the neighbourhood which the old woman proposed to Candide to make do with till the company could be provided for in a better manner. Cunegonde did not know she had grown ugly, for nobody had told her of it, and she reminded Candide of his promise in so positive a tone that the good man durst not refuse her. He therefore intimated to the baron that he intended marrying his sister.
"I will not suffer," said the baron, "such meanness on her part, and such insolence on yours. I will never be reproached with this scandalous thing. My sister's children would never be able to enter the church in Germany. No, my sister shall only marry a baron of the empire."
Cunegonde flung herself at his feet and bathed them with her tears. Still he was inflexible.
"Thou foolish fellow," said Candide, "I have delivered thee out of the galleys, I have paid thy ransom, and thy sister's also. She was a scullion and is very ugly, yet I have the goodness to marry her. And dost thou pretend to oppose the match? I should kill thee again, were I only to consult my anger."
"Thou mayst kill me again," said the baron, "but thou shalt not marry my sister, at least whilst I am living."
Chapter 30. The conclusion. At the bottom of his heart, Candide had no wish to marry Cunegonde, but the extreme impertinence of the baron determined him to conclude the match, and Cunegonde pressed him so strongly that he could not go from his word. He consulted Pangloss, Martin, and the faithful Cacambo. Pangloss drew up an excellent paper, wherein he proved that the Baron had no right over his sister, and that according to all the laws of the Empire she might marry Candide with her left hand. Martin was for throwing the Baron into the sea. Cacambo decided that it would be better to deliver him up again to the captain of the galley, after which they thought to send him back to the general father of the order at Rome by the first ship. This advice was well received. The old woman approved it. They said not a word to his sister. The thing was executed for a little money, and they had the double pleasure of entrapping a Jesuit and punishing the pride of a German baron. It is natural to imagine that after so many disasters, Candide, married and living with the philosopher Pangloss, the philosopher Martin, the prudent Cacambo, and the old woman, having besides brought so many diamonds from the country of the ancient Incas, must have led a very happy life. But he was so much imposed upon by the Jews that he had nothing left except his small farm. His wife became uglier every day, more peevish and unsupportable. The old woman was infirm and even more fretful than Cunegonde. Cacambo, who worked in the garden and took vegetables for sale to Constantinople, was fatigued with hard work and cursed his destiny. Pangloss was in despair at not shining in some German university. For Martin, he was firmly persuaded that he would be as badly off elsewhere, and therefore bore things patiently. Candide, Martin, and Pangloss sometimes disputed about morals and metaphysics. They often saw, passing under the windows of their farm, boats full of effendis, pashas, and cadis who were going into banishment to Lemnos, Mytilene, or Erzeroum. And they saw other cadis, pashas, and effendis coming to supply the place of the exiles, and afterwards exiled in their turn. They saw heads decently impaled for presentation at the palace gate. Such spectacles as these increased the number of their dissertations, and when they did not dispute, time hung so heavily upon their hands that one day the old woman ventured to say to them, "I want to know what is worse, to be ravished 100 times by negro pirates, to have a buttock cut off, to run the gauntlet among the Bulgarians, to be whipped and hanged at an auto da fe, to be dissected, to row in the galleys, in short, to go through all the miseries we have undergone, or to stay here and have nothing to do?"
"It is a great question," said Candide.
This discourse gave rise to new reflections, and Martin especially concluded that man was born to live either in a state of distracting inquietude or of lethargic disgust. Candide did not quite agree to that, but he affirmed nothing. Pangloss owned that he had always suffered horribly, but as he had once asserted that everything went wonderfully well, he asserted it still, though he no longer believed it. What helped to confirm Martin in his detestable principles, to stagger Candide more than ever, and to puzzle Pangloss, was that one day they saw Paquette and Friar Giroflée land at the farm in extreme misery. They had soon squandered their 3,000 piastres, parted, were reconciled, quarrelled again, were thrown into jail, had escaped, and Friar Giroflée had at length become a Turk. Paquette continued her trade, wherever she went, but made nothing of it. "I foresaw," said Martin to Candide, "that your presence would soon be dissipated, and only make them the more miserable. You have rolled in millions of money, you and Cacambo, and yet you are not happier than Friar Giroflée and Paquette."
"Ah," said Pangloss to Paquette, "Providence has then brought you amongst us again, my poor child. Do you know that you cost me the tip of my nose, an eye, and an ear, as you may see? Eh? Oh, what a world this is!"
And now this new adventure set them philosophizing more than ever. In the neighbourhood there lived a very famous dervish who was esteemed the best philosopher in all Turkey, and they went to consult him. Pangloss was the speaker.
"Master," said he, "we come to beg you to tell why so strange an animal as man was made."
"With what meddlest thou?" said the dervish. "Is it thy business?"
"But, reverend father," said Candide, "there is horrible evil in this world."
"What signifies it," said the dervish, "whether there be evil or good? When his highness sends a ship to Egypt, does he trouble his head whether the mice on board are at their ease or not?"
What, then, must we do?
Said Pangloss.
Hold your tongue, answered the dervish.
I was in hopes, said Pangloss, that I should reason with you a little about causes and effects, about the best of possible worlds, the origin of evil, the nature of the soul, and the pre-established harmony.
At these words, the dervish shut the door in their faces. During this conversation, the news was spread that two viziers and the mufti had been strangled at Constantinople, and that several of their friends had been impaled. This catastrophe made a great noise for some hours. Pangloss, Candide, and Martin, returning to the little farm, saw a good old man taking the fresh air at his door under an orange bower. Pangloss, who was as inquisitive as he was argumentative, asked the old man what was the name of the strangled mufti.
"I do not know," answered the worthy man, "and I have not known the name of any mufti nor of any vizier. I am entirely ignorant of the event you mention. I presume, in general, that they who meddle with the administration of public affairs die, sometimes miserably, and that they deserve it. But I never trouble my head about what is transacting at Constantinople. I content myself with sending there for sale the fruits of the garden which I cultivate."
Having said these words, he invited the strangers into his house. His two sons and two daughters presented them with several sorts of sherbet, which they made themselves, with kaimak enriched with the candied peel of citrons, with oranges, lemons, pineapples, pistachio nuts, and mocha coffee unadulterated with the bad coffee of Batavia or the American Islands. After which the two daughters of the honest Mussulman perfumed the stranger's beards. "You must have a vast and magnificent estate," said Candide to the Turk.
"I have only 20 acres," replied the old man. "I and my children cultivate them. Our labour preserves us from three great evils, weariness, vice, and want."
Candide, on his way home, made profound reflections on the old man's conversation. "This honest Turk," said he to Pangloss and Martin, "seems to be in a situation far preferable to that of the six kings with whom we had the honour of supping."
"Grandeur," said Pangloss, "is extremely dangerous according to the testimony of philosophers. For, in short, Eglon, king of Moab, was assassinated by Ehud. Absalom was hung by his hair and pierced with 3 darts. King Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, was killed by Baasa. King Elah by Zimri. Ahaziah by Jehu. Ataliah by Jehoiada, the kings Jehoiakim, Jeconiah, and Zedekiah were led into captivity. You know how perished Croesus, Astyages, Darius, Dionysus of Syracuse, Pyrrhus, Perseus, Hannibal, Jugurtha, Ariovistus, Caesar, Pompey, Nero, Otho, Vitellus, Domitian, Richard the Second of England, Edward the Second, Henry VI, Richard III, Mary Stuart, Charles I, the 3 Henrys of France, the Emperor Henry IV, you know.
"I know also," said Candide, "that we must cultivate our garden."
You are right," said Pangloss. "For when man was first placed in the Garden of Eden, he was put there ut operaritur eum, that he might cultivate it, which shows that man was not born to be idle."
"Let us work," said Martin, "without disputing. It is the only way to render life tolerable." The whole little society entered into this laudable design according to their different abilities. Their little plot of land produced plentiful crops. Cunigonde was, indeed, very ugly, but she became an excellent pastry cook. Paquette worked at embroidery. The old woman looked after the linen. They were all, not excepting Friar Giroflée, of some service or other, for he made a good joiner and became a very honest man. Pangloss sometimes said to Candide,
There is a concatenation of events in this best of all possible worlds, for if you had not been kicked out of a magnificent castle for love of Miss Cunegonde, if you had not been put into the Inquisition, if you had not walked over America, if you had not stabbed the Baron, if you had not lost all your sheep from the fine country of El Dorado, you would not be here eating preserved citrons and pistachio nuts.
All that is very well, answered Candide, but let us cultivate our garden.